So I've been sprucing up the podcast studio lately and have added some killer new decor. You've probably recognized some of this artist's work if you're in the outdoor space at all. Ryan Kirby's classic white-tailed deer prints, they've got this awesome vintage vibe that just works whether you're at home, your office, or even at hunt camp. One of my favorites is the growth and maturity of the white-tailed buck print. It captures the life cycle of the white-tailed buck as he matures from year to year. Not only does it look great, but it's also packed with info to help you age deer on the hoof. One cool thing about these prints is they've been approved by the National Deer Association, so you know that the info is spot on. Ryan Kirby's work is top-notch. I know you know the magazine Field & Stream. When they decided to go back to print, they reached out to Ryan to do the cover art of their first two issues back to print. Go check out his stuff at ryankirby.com, and my listeners can get a 10% discount by using the code CHECKOUT10 at checkout. Welcome to the Shepherd's Crook Podcast. This ministry exists to provide coaching, resources, and events for pastors and church members. My name is Jared Sparks. Join me as I talk pastoral ministry, applied theology like manhood and womanhood, political theology, and cultural analysis with a little bit of hunting and fishing thrown in. I'm a husband, a father, and a pastor, and I'm here to remind you of the chief pastor and our King, Jesus. Hello and welcome back to the show. Hope you guys are having a great day today. Hey, I want to thank you for coming on the intensive. If you were one of the guys that were able to make it, if you were one of the father-son combos that were there on the river and survived, thanks so much for being there. If you've not caught the last episode, please catch the recap, and you'll want to make sure and check that out, and it would just maybe spark some memories from last week. We had a really good time. Thanks so much for coming. For those who have been looking on the outside, looking in, checking out the river trips over the last 8 years or so, please consider coming next year. Right now is the good time to put it on the calendar. It's May 7th to the 9th of 2026, and Dr. Jim Orrick is going to be there speaking. So is Bill Smith and my buddy Sam Kaiser. So we're going to have a good old confessional Baptist, a confessional Presbyterian, and a Pentecostal. So we're all going to have a fight to the death and have a lot of fun. So we're going to have a good time on the river next year. Please consider coming. All right, I'm excited about this conversation today. I have been enjoying his work, and you've probably seen some of his prints or work out, and you're going to just realize today, oh my goodness, that's that guy. I'm talking to Ryan Kirby today. Ryan, how's it going, brother?
Going great, man. I appreciate you having me here.
Absolutely. Thanks for making the time. Really thankful this worked out.
Yeah, for sure. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, let's go ahead and pray, ask the Lord's help, and then we'll get into our conversation. Father, I just thank you for this opportunity that we have, for all the problems that the internet can bring up in so many people's lives. Here is such just an incredible opportunity we have just to talk to people across the country and being just mutually encouraged and built up. And it's been awesome to see Ryan's work and the gifts that you've given him, how that's expressed itself out, and it's been recognized everywhere. And we just thank you that you give us certain gifts. And as we work hard with our hands and do what you've called us to do one day at a time, God, you bring fruit and blessing. We get to see that. And so I just ask that this conversation would honor you, and it'd be a cool time getting to talk to Ryan. And it's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
All right, brother, why don't you bring us up to speed? Because as we get going here, some of the people that listen to me and are familiar with what I do will be familiar with what you do, and they'll think, oh man, yeah, this is great. I know this guy. But why don't you just bring us up to speed? Tell us about yourself, your family, and then what it is that you do.
Okay. My name's Ryan Kirby. I am 42 years old. I grew up in the Midwest, moved to the South after I graduated college there. I started out as a graphic designer in the outdoor industry, but I was always into fine art on the side. Loved hunting in the outdoors, grew up on a farm, so that's always been an important part of my life. We'll probably get into a little bit more of the story and all that, but now we live in Boone, North Carolina, in the mountains in Western Carolina. My wife, Kim, and I have two kids, an 8-year-old boy and a 5-year-old girl, Rhett and Brooklyn. And a few years ago, where I work now, we bought an 8-acre property that has a house, and it's actually a guy's airplane hangar. He had a
small, really?
Yeah.
Very cool.
So It was a 4,000 square foot building, and we renovated half of it to be my office and studio, a small informal gallery, and then a warehouse where we ship prints, and we have a couple of part-time employees. So
Very cool.
the walls behind me are bare, but they usually have originals on them.
Nice.
It's good, man. We have a really, really good life. We live out in the country now. So the kids are able to run and play, and just started the garden this weekend. So we've got a good life, man. We're blessed and we're happy.
Good deal. I had a good buddy that I grew up with that actually works in Boone. He's a professor of music, I believe, and he's
Oh,
at
it
the
happened?
school. So Dr. Andy Hannon,
Okay.
and he's been there, I think, maybe a decade now or so, something like that. So
Yeah.
very, very cool. I've heard it's beautiful there. And skiing, I believe there's skiing there, right?
It's in the mountains. So people think North Carolina is like the deep south, but we're at 3,400 feet elevation. Low to mid 80s is as hot as it'll get for the
Okay.
most here. But we'll have just as much snow and, temperatures in the teens. But my wife, what brought us to Boone is she got a job in the MBA program. She got an MBA
Okay.
back in the day. And we were living down by Lake Norman, and I had started my own business. I'd went out on my own, so I could work anywhere. And she was working for Wachovia, which became Wells Fargo, and it
Okay.
just be real stressful and just not worth it. She was in IT audit, which I tell people was it was the worst Christmas parties ever, because it was IT people and they were auditors. And
Oh
it was
man,
like,
sounds awful.
she, it just wasn't worth it anymore. So she was looking for something else. A job in the MBA program came up at App, and that's what brought us to Boone. So
Okay, very cool.
yeah,
Yeah,
that's
very
how
cool.
we got here.
So I'm recording right now in Carbondale, Illinois. I grew up in Marion,
Yeah,
and
man.
right down the road from you, I think I saw somewhere you went to Bradley, and we're right in, SIU country down here.
Yep.
And if you're 42, you graduate in 01, or did you
Yeah,
graduate
2000. I
2000?
turned
Okay.
43 in 2 weeks. Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. Well, you got me by a couple of years. I was 02. I graduated in 02 and from Marion, but went down to Tennessee. So I went to the South for a little bit and ended up back here. And now we're here for the long haul. It looks like I've been pastoring a church here for about 9 years, and we love it. This is a lot of family here still. My family ended up moving to Missouri, because there's a little bit more freedom there than Illinois. But yeah, so we're going to the Biltmore here in July. It's our my wife and I's 15th anniversary, so we're going to the Biltmore, and then we're going to go on through to Charleston, South Carolina. But we're looking forward to spending some time in North Carolina. If it's not been washed away, I mean, a lot of that area, I guess, in that Biltmore area down there got swept away in the hurricane, from what I hear, anyways. But okay, so
Love that, man. The Biltmore is awesome.
yeah, that's what I hear. I mean, everybody that went there, I don't think I've ever met anybody who went to the Biltmore and said, "Yeah, not that great."
Yeah. When Kim and I were dating, I really tried to impress her one Christmas and took her to the Biltmore, and we did like a carriage ride and all that kind of stuff. Like, and now that you're older, you have kids, you got a busy life, baseball, dance, all that kind of stuff. It's like, what do you want for your birthday?
Yeah, right.
Like back in the day, I got a lot of brownie points for taking her to the Biltmore, and
Gotcha.
it was cool.
Yeah, well, we're looking forward to it, and we all have these grand ideas of, what we're going to do on our 10th anniversary. We're going to go back to Hawaii. That's where we went on our honeymoon. And then we ended up going to Chattanooga with three of our children. We have a fourth now, but we went with the three because it was right in 2020. My wife was pregnant with our, let's see. No, we had two. She was pregnant with our third in our 10-year anniversary. We ended up going to Chattanooga and had to bring all our kids because everybody was sick. I was like, well, we're still going to go, but we can't leave them with the in-laws now. And everybody was freaked out in 2020 because of everything. So we're like the only family walking around Chattanooga with no masks on, about to get kicked out of our hotel with a bunch of kids on our anniversary. So life changes your plans a little bit sometimes.
Life has been crazy in 2020, man. That's for sure.
That's wild. All right, so you grew up on the farm in Illinois. So you loved the outdoors, and it was just kind of what you did growing up. And I guess you hunted and fished as well. So where did this love of art, how did you realize, man, I got this gift and I just enjoy this, but I'm also good at it? There's a lot of things that people enjoy. They're not too good at it, but you've got this opportunity where you're really good at it. When did that discovery take place for you?
Really, it's kind of like anything. It was more of a gradual thing for me. We grew up on the farm there, and I was like obsessed with just tagging along with my dad. And you know, riding on the tractor, and he drove a concrete truck in the summers, and I'd take naps in the front seat of the concrete truck, you know, like things that you could do in the '80s that are forbidden now.
Oh yeah. We're the last free generation, man.
Dude. I mean, I remember, riding with dad on the concrete truck. It just had a bench seat. I'm sure it didn't have a seat belt. I didn't have a car seat, and I would take naps while they were pouring the concrete. Like, he was at work on the job, you know?
That's great.
I just love tagging along. We had about 20 to 25 head of cattle when I was younger. We did row crops. And I was in that generation where I think we had about 145 acres at the time, but like between my grandpa and my uncle and all of our friends, you could hunt anywhere.
Okay.
You
know? Yeah.
We fished in farm ponds. We ice fished. We did all that kind of stuff. And looking back, you didn't really realize how fortunate you were growing up that way, but that was my childhood. And so I loved deer, turkeys, doves, rabbit, squirrels, fishing. I was obsessed with fishing. Like Bill Nance and Babe Winkleman were my
yeah, right.
But I remember watching Babe Winkleman's VHS tapes of his seminars and stuff like that. So that came first in my life. I had a really, really good middle and high school art teacher, you know, and in those days, like the art teacher teaches middle school through high school. In a town of, you know, 3,200 people, real small town. I had 49 kids in my graduating high school class. So he was my art teacher from like sixth grade all the way on. And he really encouraged us in the junior duck stamp program, which, are you a duck hunter at all?
I'm not. At some point I plan on doing that, but not at this point.
You have to buy a federal duck stamp as part of a license, and that money goes to conservation. And they have a big time art contest for the winner of the federal duck stamp contest.
Okay.
So super competitive, you know, they get judged in Washington, D.C., and it's a very competitive, there's documentaries on it about how competitive it is to win the federal duck stamp.
Okay.
And to put it in perspective, like the year that I won the junior, the federal contest winnings were 1.5 million. So
wow. Okay. Yeah.
You become an instant millionaire and your career would be set if you won the adult. Well, they had a junior contest that modeled that.
Okay.
And so you could enter, you know, elementary school, middle school, high school, and they had a state contest. The 50 state winners would go to a national contest and they would have a national judging. So My high school art teacher was really instrumental in helping us along with that, giving us reference for the ducks, helping us enter. And at that point, I started to discover that I just kind of had a little bit of a natural ability.
Gotcha.
You know, art, it really comes down to any piece of art is putting the right color, the right shape, the right stroke in the right place. And that's all. And you do that 1,000 times and you have a painting. Right.
Okay.
So the key is being able to see what you want and then having the hand-eye coordination and the technical ability to mix the right colors and apply the paint.
Mm-hmm.
It's a ton of hand-eye coordination, really. And I did have a natural ability to kind of see shapes and unpack how things worked in the natural world and understand dimensions and things like that. And then I had the hand-eye coordination to replicate that.
Yeah.
Combine that with teaching, and that's pretty much art. So that's where some of the natural ability comes in. But Mr. Mullins, my high school art teacher, really helped me grow and refine that. But then underlying that was the interest in the natural world, hunting, fishing, livestock.
Right.
So that's where all this sort of culminated for me.
Very cool. And
honestly, man, I was way more of just a blue collar country kid than I was an artist. You know?
Yeah. You got to break the mold of what an artist kind of looks like, talks like, acts like.
And, you know, I remember, so my freshman year, I won the state contest, and then I got 22nd in the country. My sophomore year, I won the state and got fourth in the country. And then my junior year, I won state and got first in the country.
Okay.
And so I had won the national contest, and we got to go to Washington, D.C. to see the judging of the federal contest. So the federal is the big money maker. That's the adults. That's the professional. And I'm just some kid that kind of gets, you know, they're winning millions and we got a $2,500 scholarship and a free trip to DC, which was cool.
Yeah.
But I remember I was so bummed because it was November 4th and I was going to miss. Oh,
gosh. Yeah.
Look back and it's like, man, we had a VIP tour of every national monument in DC and got to see everything and all that. And I was bummed because I couldn't hear it.
You got to be in the woods, man.
That's kind of in a nutshell, that's kind of who I was and how
yeah,
I was.
Gotcha. Gotcha. That kind of gives you a frame of reference of where you were at that time of your life as well. But I think that time of the year, I didn't start hunting until I was 35. So it's only been the last. There's a guy at our church that said, hey, I want you to come out to my farm and I want you to give hunting a shot. And I thought, you know, I grew up playing sports and grew up in the woods, actually, but didn't grow up hunting at all. Didn't come from a hunting family. And man, I went out that first year and just loved it. And ever since then, so then I got into bow hunting and the people that are listening in, they know I've talked a lot about this over the last few years. We got to go bear hunting and been in the woods hunting turkey. And we took a men's trip from our church and we went down to Texas and chased down some hogs in the woods in Texas.
That had been awesome.
And that was a good time. It's like the best church event ever, you know? And so very cool. So if just because people may not know here, I'm going to pull this workout from the latest, or this is, I believe the spring. No, this is fall of last year. The Club 1871 or whatever it is. Picked up the new Field and Stream. And so there's some of Ryan's work right there. You may be familiar with the Whitetail Growth and Maturity print as well. That a lot of people have seen that. My brother-in-law has that on his wall. And when I started to connect some of these dots of who you were and what your work is, I know on Outdoor Life as well, you've been on the cover of that, just really everywhere in the outdoor world. But your work is incredible. And it does, it's almost like nostalgic as well, because it pulls you back into some of these old prints from Field and Stream and Outdoor Life, where you kind of connect the dots in history as well, where it looks just it's fresh. You have a fresh take and some old covers and things that have been done in the past. But man, is it such a good, I mean, it's just incredible. You know, you can just sit and look at a picture like that and just stare at it and continue to find new things about it that are awesome. You got a guy wearing old Woolrich stuff in the back right there, which is really cool. Classic hunting gear. Feel it's just incredible, man. You got great work, and I love your Instagram as well. You know, you scroll down your Instagram, you're a great follow. We'll make sure and put all that stuff in the show notes so people can find the links to all your work. So now you're out of high school, you go to college, graphic design, all of that. But then now that's a long way from being a business owner. I guess somewhere along the way you get married, and then how do you begin to say what I'm doing is valuable? I got a gift here. I'm going to turn this into a business. How was that progression?
Well, I guess the fundamental part is, you know, I grew up on a farm. My parents were really like kind of conservative, fiscal, responsible. Like I remember watching my mom do her checkbook ledger, you know, like people don't do
to the penny.
Yeah. I mean, I was like, we went to a home ec class or something. And I was like the only kid that knew how to balance a check like before class. And I credit my parents for that, because I just saw that. But when I won the junior duck stamp contest, they will let you make prints for a year. You sign a contract with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And so I made prints, and I was like running a ledger of how much they sold for. And I had to calculate and turn my books over to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and I paid royalties back to them. So, you know, at 16, I was sort of running an art business. But, you know, and I did commissioned art, and I baled hay in the summers. That was my summer job.
Okay.
And so, I had a little bit of an experience like running a business, and my parents taught me how to manage money. And so I had a little bit of a background in that. But then I went to college, and I knew in the back of my mind, I wanted to paint full time one day, but it's such a big stretch. Like, most fine art people just go and teach college, and you just get stuck in academia forever. You know, like painting full time out of college as a professional artist is like saying, I want to go to the NBA out of high school.
Yeah,
man, it can be done, but it's rare. And so I knew that I wanted a marketable skill. I went to Bradley actually to study engineering and got a scholarship there. Funny story, I was actually, we couldn't afford Bradley, but I was actually valedictorian of 49 kids.
Okay.
Bradley gives a half scholarship for valedictorian, whether it's 49 or 490. So
okay, great.
I got a scholarship to Bradley. I was the top of 49, you know? So I went there, but I was going to study engineering. And then the more I got into it, the more they had this thing called graphic design, and it was on these big Mac tower computers, you know, that they had. And it was basically, it's basically like visual communication. Like, how do you lay something out and design a book cover, a magazine cover, an advertising, a billboard in a way that can communicate a message? I had to learn all the technical sides, like how to operate a Mac computer and Photoshop and Illustrator that I didn't know. But that really resonated with me. At the same time I was doing that, I was donating art to the Adams County National Wild Turkey Federation chapter.
Okay.
So I'm kind of still have one foot in the outdoors wildlife world, but I'm studying graphic design. And my senior year of college, I answered a classified ad in the back of Turkey Call magazine as a graphic designer for the National Wild Turkey Federation.
Right.
So got the job. I had the hunting background and information and knowledge, but also the talent to do the art and design stuff. Worked there for a few years. And then what happened is the Turkey Fed at that time was a revolving door of talent. They would hire people from all over the country. And that was kind of the springboard into the industry. And they'd go work for an agency or a marketing department or something like that. And within a few years, they were kicking back freelance work to me because they knew what I was capable of. And now they're in a new role and they need someone to illustrate a shotgun, how a shotgun works.
Okay.
So I was doing that, and I got to the point I was working more and making more money on the side freelancing than I was my full-time job. There's a lot of personal stuff I'm leaving out here, but in the middle of that, I'd met Kim, didn't have any kids, nothing like that. And so it's like, if I don't launch out on my own, I never will.
Okay.
And so at this point, I had kind of run the accounting for my freelance business, kind of learned how all that worked, new pricing and stuff. And so at that point, I launched out on my own. In the first few years on my own, I was doing graphic design more than anything.
Okay. You know,
that client work is very steady. It pays the bills, but it can be a grind. You're always on a schedule. And so what I would do is I would paint when the phone wasn't ringing. So I was always working. I was always showing up to work. If I didn't have any paid work that was paying the bills, I'd go paint.
Okay.
So it's more riskier side. And I always kind of balanced the complete unknown risky side of art with having some client work to, you know, pay the bills while we were going. And then over time, I shifted away from client work. And about 2 years ago, I walked away from it entirely. So now okay. We just my own art.
Man, phenomenal. So you had all these connections in the outdoor world then, and even with the magazine side of things. So let's talk Field and Stream is what people know the most. Outdoor Life, Field and Stream probably, or what most of the guys listening in are most familiar with. So what was the connection and what was that like when you were commissioned to do some work for Field and Stream? And I don't know if you did in the old Field and Stream. So I went before Field and Stream, I think they ended print in 18 or 19.
Yep.
I had gone to this expo for Outdoor Life, Field and Stream combo event in Paducah, Kentucky, and go down there and they say, yeah, you're going to get a subscription with your ticket. You get a subscription for the next year included, and not knowing that they were closing up shop with the print side of things. So it's like, oh great. You know, like free subscription. Thanks a ton.
Awesome.
And some Field and Stream folks out there, you know, come on, throw me a hat or something. Anyways, when they came back, when Eric Church and I guess Wallen bought it their group bought it, and I saw it was coming back to print, I was thrilled. Tens of thousands of people were thrilled. What was it like then being commissioned to say, hey, will you do the cover of these first two?
I will. I'm always going to go. I'm a really kind of blue collar, and I approach my career with like a lunch pail mentality. Like I'm going to show up and I'm going to do my work. And so I'm always kind of bring it back to that. You know, everybody thinks that they see stuff and it's like super fancy and super, it's a big deal and all this kind of stuff. But most times when you see that, it started like 2 years before.
Right.
And worked up to it. So I was doing design work then, and they have a SHOT Show, Shooting, Hunting, and Outdoor Trade Show in Las Vegas every year. And that's where all the big companies go. I was doing some work. Winchester Ammo has always been my biggest client from day one. And I was doing their advertising. So for example, we do all of their new product advertising. We start in like September. And then we produce the catalog, the print ads, the photography, and then they launch it like the first week of January at SHOT Show for the year. And I was trying to, you know, get more clients, get more Winchester's work, get more of my foot in the ground. And so, you know, I paid my own way to go out to Las Vegas to SHOT Show.
Okay.
And I had a couple buddies that were going out for their own companies. I'd crash in their hotel room. I mean, I'm, you know, at this point, like, I remember months where I had $5,000 in expenses and I made $500 in income. Like, there were some real months. And this was kind of the year I'm, like, crashing on, you know, extra beds and couches in their hotel room, but trying to make connections in the industry.
Okay.
And going back to, I was doing all this fine art when the phone wasn't ringing and nobody was watching, nobody was paying attention. I had kind of a body of work that I built up, and I had it on an iPad. And at these shows, you never really know who you're going to meet. You never really can have an agenda. You know, these people all have meetings and agendas and appearances that I'm trying to get to know. So I'm kind of, I've got to be real flexible. And last minute, somebody invited me to a cocktail hour after the show closed with Bonnier, who owned Outdoor Life, Popular Mechanics, and all this stuff. And I had done some work for their magazine, like smaller illustrations in there. And I remember I met Andrew McKean, who was the editor at the time. And we just got to talking about deer hunting and art and stuff. And I told him I was an artist. And he's like, oh, yeah. He's like, well, I was like, yeah, I got some of my work right here. And I had it on the iPad.
Okay.
So he flipped through and he said, man, this is awesome. Like, we're thinking about bringing art back to the cover, and we haven't done it in 25 years. Do you want to do this? I was like, yeah, man.
Yeah, of course.
So that was my first big cover, was Outdoor Life. And I think we did seven of those. We did only that, and they were still in print at the time, but I was the first artist. So people see, like, oh man, they chose you as the first artist to be bring art back to the cover of Outdoor Life. But what you don't see is the, you know, 11 paintings I did when no one was watching. I had no guarantee of, I just kept working and grinding.
Yeah, right.
And I took a chance on myself, spent probably most of what I had in my checking account to go to Las Vegas and take a shot, and had a chance meeting with somebody. And, you know, to go back to spirituality, you look back and you can see God's hand in your life orchestrate.
That's right.
But in real time, man, you're just going, you're just hustling, just grinding, you're just trying new things. So, you know, people ask, like, oh, well, I bet it was an honor to be chosen by Outdoor Life. And it's like, yeah, it was, but unless I did the 15 steps before that, when nobody was looking, we don't get there. So I had done several of their covers, and, you know, a lot of these editors talk, they kind of know each other. It's a real small world. You know, there may be 12 editors across the board at Field and Stream and Outdoor Life, and they all talk at these shows and stuff. And so when Field and Stream was going to come back to print, my name was on the short list because they mainly knew I could hit deadlines. And I was easy with, and I could produce and deliver. So that's how that whole thing came about. And they emailed me and told me they were bringing it back to print, and they do the first cover of a draft.
Very cool.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, I think opportunities like that are a result of long hours, and exactly what you're saying, when nobody's looking, you know, you're putting your hands to the plow and trusting that God's going to provide, that there's going to be, you know, at the end of this, whatever you're doing, that this is going to be worth it, even in months or days or weeks that it feels like nothing's being accomplished at all. I think that's a honorable, you know, mentality in really all of life with your work, and especially as men, as, you know, doing whatever the work is that God has laid in your hands, do it with all your might and trust him with the results here. You can't make things happen. But then you look back over your life and you realize, man, look what God's done, and look at all these connections here that, you know, really were either impossible or providential, where God just put the right person in the right path, the right time. And then all this work that's been done behind the scenes, you see the fruition of it. Man, that's been evident in your life. So let's switch gears a little bit. So did you grow up in a Christian home? Let's talk about how you became a Christian, and what was that like in your life?
Woo, we're getting messy here.
There we go. That's right. We're getting to the nitty gritty.
So my journey to faith was a disaster for the most part. We were the total, I think you call them creasters, Christmas and
Yeah, that's right. Creasters, man.
My dad refused to go to church. My mom would bring us to the Presbyterian church there, Bethel Presbyterian in Hamilton. And it was, you know, my grandma was like one of the cornerstones. Like they did the social hours and the luncheons and stuff in the fellowship hall. And she was an old church lady, you know, for the most part. So mom would bring us on Christmas and Easter. Had very, very, very little, if any, like grounding in faith. We didn't even really do the Sunday school type stuff.
Okay.
And grew up that way. And I think my epic downfall is that I always had enough grit and talent and ability. I could perform and get results on my own.
Okay.
And I was all, and I looking back, it was kind of like, I don't really need God. I don't really need God. Just, you know, I can do my own thing. And I had a lot of underlying issues kind of festering in my life that I didn't realize at the time. I had a lot of performance issue. My identity was tied up in my performance and what I could do and how I could perform on a football or basketball field or what I could create and all that kind of stuff. And from the outside looking in, I really had it all together, but on the inside, I was a mess. And when I went to Bradley, I met a girl and we both just kind of fell head over heels for each other, for lack of a better term. We both had kind of some underlying issues and we kind of latched onto each other, but you know, don't like it, it was odd how perfect everything was. We
okay.
knew we knew this and knew that. As I started getting towards the end of college, I just was kind of a wreck internally, and that was starting to kind of show itself. I think I was depressed, had a lot of anxiety about what I was going to do after college, and that's a big transition time for a lot of people. You know, you're
definitely.
So there's some underlying stress there, but long story short, man, she broke up with me, and I was devastated. And that was really the straw that broke the camel's back for me, because all of my issues just kind of surfaced at that point. Dude, I just hit rock bottom. I was hospitalized for depression and suicidal thoughts two different times. I had to take a semester off of college and move back home. I was just a wreck, man. The rug had just been pulled out from under my feet. I just couldn't get myself back up.
Right.
But you know, there were some people that loved on me and told me about Jesus. I accepted Christ at like 2 a.m. on some mutual friend's living room one time. And that didn't fix anything. It made it worse.
Was it just like that? You're all fixed?
And honestly, man, looking back, I thought that's how it was going to be. Like, oh, yeah, I just do that. And then all this stuff is fixed and we go right back to normal.
Right.
Man, it probably took me a decade to work through my issues and I don't know. I'm just a wreck. I couldn't. I was just in such a fog that it took me a long time to work through that stuff. And I was a Christian at this point the whole time. I even worked for a church for a year doing.
Oh, really?
In Augusta, Georgia. You know, all these the churches now have like media people and sound and light people. You know, and I was a designer. And so, man, even though I was like committed, I was in a Bible study, I was reading my Bible, I called myself a Christian, I was working for a church, I kind of had to work through some things for years. It took me a long time to get there. So that's really how it became a Christian. I had to be broken, and I was
right.
Bang.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting with, you know, the Christianity is the only religion in the world that declares justification on the front end. And where people get confused with that is, you know, the promise of the gospel of Jesus is that Jesus died as a substitutionary sacrifice in our place. There's our sins upon him, but he also lived a perfect life, and that's credited to those who are in Christ Jesus. And so the reason we're justified is that we are counted righteous. And I think a lot of people get this idea, especially in more charismatic circles, that that we're just made with we're made righteous, that those who are born again automatically now are just walking this road of sanctification with no issues or problems and kind of flying on the clouds. And the reality is sanctification is this long process the rest of our life, where at any given moment, you know, our trust is always and only in Christ and not in the strength of our hands, the strength of our heart, or our righteousness or sanctification. It's always in what Christ has done for us. And I think at any given place in our life, then we look at our life and it's like, yep, still today, you know, Jared, I've been a preacher now for 16 years, husband and father, and, you know, walking with the Lord for a long time since I was a little boy. And still today I'm reminded, man, I don't have it all figured out yet. It's just, I just don't, you know?
Yeah.
And so I don't really think there's ever a time where we just arrive, where we just think, you know, like, you know, I've got it all now, and I've arrived, and I've got it all figured out.
Yep. That was definitely my story for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So now you end up then, you met your wife, and now you're a dad. You got a couple kids now. And what's it like, you know, they're not growing up on a farm with uncles and property all over the place. So how do you, you know, it's every man who has children, I think it's our challenge is to not overburden our kids with what we enjoy, but also wanting to bring them into what we enjoy because we want them to enjoy that as well. And how do you walk that balance? You said your oldest is 8, your youngest is 5. We've got 10 down to 16 months. So we got boy, boy, girl, boy. And yeah, we're having fun, man. I got my oldest in the woods the last 2 years and I got him out there with a crossbow and he's missed, I think, 7 deer at this point. He's getting good at going out and sitting with me and it's part of the process, you know, but I don't want to overburden them. That's the other thing is I don't want to, you know, put them in situations where they're just going to be unsuccessful over and over again. But what's that like for you? I mean, how do you now living in Boone without that kind of property? I know you got your own that you live on. What's it like raising them in the outdoor world?
You pretty much hit the nail on the head. You want, it's kind of like anything. You want them to experience the joy of being successful, but you don't want to short circuit that either. And you really want them to be successful in the woods, but you also know that like, sometimes they just want to be with you. Sometimes
they
just want to hang out. I remember I've got permission on a couple places and we actually bought 34 acres up the road that we're growing Christmas trees on.
Oh, heck yeah, man. That's awesome.
It's a cool, different experience.
What, let me interrupt. What kind of trees are you growing?
They're Fraser firs.
Fraser firs. Okay.
So we are in a part of the country where, I mean, a ton, I'm not going to say the majority, but a lot of the Christmas trees come from the 3 or 4 surrounding counties around us.
Okay.
Country. The climate is just right. Christmas trees have to grow on a hill, these Fraser firs.
Okay.
So they sit in a bottom and they get wet feet, they'll die. They're really susceptible to fungi and stuff like that. So we have a really good climate for it. And we bought that place and I had to have some income off of it to help pay for the place. So we do a share crop deal with Christmas trees with a farmer.
Okay.
We pay for the seedlings and all the inputs and provide the land and he does the labor, which
right.
is a lot of labor. You know, you've got to really keep them sprayed. You've got to shape them. You've got to, there's a, in the first couple years of life, they're really susceptible. They grow from the top, like where you put the star on the Christmas tree. Now, this might be an analogy you can use in a sermon one day.
There you go.
But they grow from the top and in, you know, in the late fall, when the deer don't have anything else to eat, if a deer comes off, they'll nip that because that's where all the nutrients are, the growth. Mm-hmm. If they nip that off, it'll really set the tree back. So these guys will go through and tie a white ribbon on the top to protect that little.
Okay.
You would put the star in the Christmas tree. Mm-hmm. Dude, we've got 16 acres and you can get, can't remember if my math is right on that, but you can get 1,000 to 1,500 trees an acre.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
There's on our little property, there's 27,000 trees.
Oh my gosh. That's just incredible.
Imagine walking the mountains, the hillside and tying 27,000 ribbons.
It's a lot of work.
And then you have to take them off in the spring so that they grow unhindered and then put them on again in the fall. So
okay.
Like, it's a lot to grow.
Yeah.
But anyway, I can't remember. I lost my train of thought. I dorked out on Christmas tree.
No, well, I interrupted there. Yeah. So
no, you're
getting... kids getting in the outdoor life and not pressuring them too much and them just wanting to be with you.
So we went on a property we had permission on and we hiked to the top of it and it was an afternoon hunt, you know, and Rhett was probably 3 or 4, maybe 4 at the time. And he's bebopping along with me, and it was like a gift. It was like manna from heaven, this turkey. We sat down, and you know, you've got a 3 or 4 year old, it's a train wreck.
Yeah, of course, it is.
You've got 17 minutes before this thing is a disaster and we have to move or something. You know, we can't really sit still. As soon as we sat down, I looked up and there was a longbeard feeding down this pasture, and he couldn't see us at all. He was already in gun range. And we just kind of stumbled into this turkey, and he walks down, and I want Rhett to see him. I was like, Rhett, do you see him? You see him? And Rhett's bobbing his head, looking around. The turkey sees it and starts kind of bobbing away. He's a little spooked, and I lean up and shoot, and I miss. And I wanted so bad to, like, Rhett to experience this and see these feathers. And I am in the biggest funk ever. I'm like, it's so mad at myself. I'm bummed. Like, how did I ruin this for my kid, you know? And he just looks up at me. He's like, hey, Dad, can we go fishing now? All right, bro. We'll go fishing.
Yeah, there you go.
Hey, he drives. When we drive past that farm, is like, Dad, that was awesome that day you missed that longbeard. And I was like, no, it wasn't. But he loves it. This year, though, he got his first turkey, and it's a little bit harder because we're kind of in the, dude, you got to sit still and shut up. You can't move. You can't talk.
It's tough.
And I get my, like, performance anxiety or drive kicks in, and there were times where you could tell he just wasn't having fun. He just didn't like it because I wanted him to be successful so bad. I was pushing him.
Right.
He just didn't love it. But anyway, we kind of got through that. He ended up shooting a Jake, and then we actually shot a double on film.
That's great.
And we're actually producing a little bit of video work with Winchester on it right now.
Very cool.
But, you know, so he's real competitive. He'll get into it. My daughter, Brooklyn, she's awesome. She just wants to come along and hang out, and she's down for anything, man.
That's fun. That's fun. Those little girls, my daughter, she's 4, and she just loves being with me, exactly what you're saying. She doesn't want to hunt. You know, she says, that's boy stuff, Dad, and doesn't want to do that. It's funny. She's got a very clear line on what's boy stuff and what's girl stuff, and and the hunting stuff is definitely the boy stuff, so she just doesn't want to do that at all, but she loves being with me. She likes me bringing back anything I harvest to see it. And
she's going to be tough, too, dude, with 3 brothers.
Oh, yeah. They're protectors, too, man. Like, we didn't get any. You're supposed to get, like, a strong-willed child, then the next is supposed to be a compliant child, and bro, we got all strong-willed children. I mean, they're leaders. They've got the aggression that you got to dial back rather than train up, and I guess in some ways that's better than just that extreme passivity that you have to build that kind of aggression. But man, they get after it. Okay, so let's shift gears one more time. Why don't you tell people where they can find your work, and then I'm just going to put links to your Winchester stuff, your actual website, to where they can buy your prints. I see that you have original prints that you have for sale, or not prints, original works, oil paintings you have for sale, and then you've got prints, a ton of them. And go ahead and just tell us where we can find your work, and then what's some new things? You got anything new coming down the line you're excited about? You'd love to tell us about what you got.
Well, they can find my work at ryankirby.com. I think all of our social handles are Ryan Kirby Art. So Facebook, Instagram. I'm an old guy that does a little bit of TikTok, and then YouTube. We have some YouTube content. As far as new stuff, so I'm actually getting into a bunch of trout work this spring, and I think we're going to release a trout print in the fall that I've got to create. So I'm about to start on that. A little bit into the fish stuff. And then I actually have a meeting tomorrow, me and a guy. It'll be over a year before it gets released, but we're going to do a book on whitetail deer, like a coffee table type book. So that'll be a big one. But yeah, they can find all of our prints there. We do original art sales of the actual original oil paintings, and most of those are bought by collectors. And then we have canvas prints of some of those original oil paintings. And then we have a line of paper prints and posters. We also got some new hats that I'm designing right now that we're going to try to have for fall. So
awesome. Heck yeah, man. Everybody loves the swag and hats and shirts and prints. I'll make sure and that's all there for you guys to find.
Hey, Ryan, this has been a lot of fun, man. There's a lot more that we could have talked about, but tried to honor your time here and wrap things up in a timely manner. So appreciate you coming on the show, guys. We've been talking to Ryan Kirby. Ryan, appreciate it.
Hey, man, thank you so much. I've enjoyed it.
Thanks again for listening to the Shepherd's Crook podcast. For more information, you can go to theshepherdscrook.co. Please consider leaving a rating or review on iTunes. And if you want to become a member of the Shepherd's Crook, please message me and we'll get you on the list. We hope you have a great rest of your day.